think we have to assume it's gone. So the material is going to hit the fan for next year's budget.
Southeast schools lose out on millions of dollars in funding. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 29th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, 9 cruise ships this season exceeded the state's pollution standards.
Nobody should be dumping stuff and using our marine waters as a mixing zone.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Lack of maintenance is the primary reason heating oil tanks contaminate drinking water, sewers, and stormwater drains. Homeowners are liable under state law for the cleanup of spills from home heating oil tanks on their property. So prevent spills by arranging an inspection of tanks and heating equipment before and during the heating season. Information online at dec.state.ak.us. Click on the Spill Prevention and Response link. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
There were fireworks in the Washington, D.C. courtroom today where Senator Ted Stevens is on trial. Alaska's senior senator is accused of lying about taking more than $250,000 in gifts from oilfield services company Vico. Judge Emmett Sullivan was upset today by the way prosecutors handled a potential witness. The situation led Stevens' lawyers to call for a mistrial. While the judge said that drastic step wasn't warranted, he is considering sanctions against the prosecution. APRN's Libby Casey is covering the trial from Washington. Hi, Libby.
Good evening, Lori.
Libby, it's not uncommon for lawyers to call for mistrials or dismissals, but it sounds like the defense gained some traction with the judge. What happened?
Well, a Vico employee named Robert, or Rocky Williams, is someone who a lot of witnesses have been talking about during their testimony. He was Vico CEO Bill Allen's right-hand man and was allegedly a type of foreman out at the Stevens Girdwood Home renovation project. The government had Williams in Washington last week interviewing him. However, they decided not to use him as a witness and sent him back to Alaska. Now, the government has to turn over to the defense any information that they uncover in the process of their investigation. And Stevens' lawyers say they were not given important information about what Williams had to say. In interviews, Williams told the government he worked fewer hours on the Stevens Girdwood home than showed up on Vico timesheets. And that matters because the biggest gift that the government is accusing Senator Stevens of taking is this house renovation. Ted Stevens and his wife did pay a contractor some money for the project, $160,000. His lawyers say they thought that covered the whole cost, but the prosecutors say Stevens must have known it cost far more. So the number of hours Williams put in at the house may be very relevant. And Rocky Williams had other things to say, that Ted Stevens only wanted the renovation to make his wife happy, and that he didn't actually want a much bigger house. He just wanted a place where he could chop and burn firewood. But what made the judge really furious was that the government sent Williams back to Alaska on a plane without notifying defense attorneys or the court that he was in Washington, even though he's under subpoena for the defense.
So, Libby, how did the judge handle it?
Well, Judge Sullivan was very angry. He told prosecutors this morning that they were treading on very thin ice, and after thinking it over during lunch, he said he found the situation very, very disturbing and amazing that the government didn't inform the court about the witness. The judge was basically on call this weekend and said he should have been notified about what was going on. Judge Sullivan said he's not suggesting at this point that there was misconduct on the government's part, but the prosecutors have to file a brief tonight defending what happened. The government says they sent Williams back to Alaska for an important reason that hasn't been disclosed publicly. It was mentioned in a motion that he has some medical issues. Now, the defense wanted a mistrial because of this, and while the judge wouldn't go that far, he did allow them to recall a witness from Friday, Cheryl Boomershine, who was a bookkeeper at Vico. She had said last week that Vico had a code for the Girdwood house and that she was told to keep it off the books. Conveniently, Boomershine was still in Washington, so she was brought back in today, and the defense had her say repeatedly that even though she handled Rocky Williams' paychecks, she had no knowledge of what he was actually doing or if he was working on side projects at the time. Now, Lori, it's important to note that all of this drama happened away from the jury. The judge just told them that Boomershine was back because additional information was available.
So after the dust settled from all that, was there any time left for other witnesses?
Yes. One, Brian Byrne, is a contractor hired by Vico to build a first floor deck, and he testified that he was told to be discreet about working at the house because it was Senator Stevens' house and because Vico is an oil field services company, not generally in the home construction business. Other Vico employees testified about putting heat tape on the roof and stringing lights, like Christmas lights, around the house and property.
Well, that Christmas lights in particular don't sound like an extravagant gift.
Yeah, but in this case, the workers estimate that these rope lights cost $10,000 to $12,000 and went all over the house, up a giant spruce tree, and were so intense that neighbors complained. It took 6 to 8 people 8 to 10 days to install them. So the prosecution saying this is a major gift.
Well, tomorrow, Libby, will the government's star witness Bill Allen take the stand?
He is expected to, after a few other witnesses are called, although the schedule is in flux and there's a lot of debate about what will and won't be told to the jurors about Allen.
All right, Libby, thanks for that update.
Thanks a lot, Lori.
Libby Casey is APRN's Washington, D.C. correspondent covering the trial of Senator Ted Stevens. A federal program that provides millions of dollars in education funding for Southeast Alaska failed to make it through the U.S. House of Representatives on Friday. It was a roller coaster ride for the Secure Rural Schools program this past week. A $2 billion four-year reauthorization was included in a tax bill that passed by a nearly unanimous vote of the U.S. Senate on Tuesday. But the House removed the rural schools provision before passing its version of the tax bill Friday morning. Efforts by the bill's supporters to get a $400 million one-year extension in another bill failed. Western Republican House members like Alaska Congressman Don Young supported the measure and blamed the Democratic majority for removing it from legislation.
You know, I was really very concerned that, you know, here we're talking about a $700 billion bailout, which I'm not going to vote for, and they didn't have enough money for rural schools. And I'm very critical of the majority right now.
But according to an Associated Press article on Friday, Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi blamed Republicans who opposed a different four-year renewal provision that failed back in June. Young was among those who voted against that earlier measure, and the legislation has also faced a presidential veto threat. The main points of disagreement have been over how to fund the program and whether it should be phased out. The loss of the money will leave a big hole in local schools and the municipalities that help fund them. Richard Underkoffler is city manager in Petersburg, which had been getting nearly $900,000 a year through the program.
I think we have to assume it's gone. Fortunately, our predecessors, you know, we didn't receive any money this year either. But fortunately, the predecessor members of the council and management had forward funded this, so we had enough to carry this year's budget with money we had received in prior years. So the material is going to hit the fan for next year's budget.
The Secure Rural Schools Act of 2000 finally expired last year after providing hundreds of millions of dollars to rural communities in or near national forests. Throughout the nation, Secure Rural Schools replaced the payments commonly known as timber receipts, which had been funded mainly through logging sales on national forests. As logging declined, Congress approved Secure Rural Schools, which stabilized and increased those payments. Southeast Alaska towns received more than $9 million a year. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, skateboarders in Petersburg win back some road rights.
Skateboarding, I feel, is just the same as these kids do. If a skateboard is no different than a bicycle, I've had a lot more close encounters with bicycles.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, proud to support public broadcasting in Alaska.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
The state says 9 of 20 cruise ships that regularly discharge wastewater in Alaska exceeded pollution control standards earlier this season. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
A total of 27 notices of violation were issued to Holland America, Princess, Norwegian, and Seven Seas ships. State officials say the violations took place in May, June, and July. They involved discharges of ammonia, copper, nickel, and zinc. Some also involved fecal coliform, chlorine, and pH. Cruise Line spokesman John Binkley says it's no surprise. He says some ships had a hard time meeting new standards put in place this year.
These were all self-reported, and they were all fairly small in terms of exceedances. Most of these violations were early on, and I think that the systems are improving. As we go forward, we're working to improve all the systems, and we feel pretty good, really, about where we've come and getting to where we need to be by the end of the season.
Industry critic Joe Geldof says many of the violations are close to the legal limits. He says that means standards that some claim could not be achieved are well within reach.
The point is, nobody should be dumping stuff and using our marine waters as a mixing zone if they can meet the Alaska water quality standards. And the industry is reluctantly stepping up to this, but they're showing that they can probably do that if they just keep whacking away at it.
The wastewater discharge standards were set up by the Cruise Ship Initiative, passed by voters 2 years ago. The industry opposed that initiative and has since complained that its standards are arbitrary and unreasonably strict. Binkley, who works for the Alaska Cruise Association, says he wants environmental regulators to decide what discharge levels are safe.
Presently, they don't have any discretion. It was set out by the initiative process. And what we feel is that they should really base it on what the science is rather than what was written in the initiative.
Some lawmakers are expected to try to change initiative provisions in the next legislative session. Their options are greater than during the first 2 years after the measure passed. Initiative author Geldof says he expects a fight.
It's a mistake to look at the industry across the board as being monolithic, but there are clearly some people who are, you know, grumbling and have sour grapes about the initiative, and they want to cut back or eliminate the taxes, and they just soon get rid of all the water quality standards.
The Cruise Ship Initiative also placed a $50 fee on passengers. In addition, it set up onboard monitors called Ocean Rangers. It also taxed gambling and corporate profits. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
The Department of Commerce and the Department of Education jointly released a report to Congress today that forecasts a shortage in the number of people pursuing and obtaining careers in fishery science. The report comes a year after the reauthorization of the Magnuson-Stevens Act, which calls for an increase in scientists who have experience in fish population dynamics and stock assessments. For member station KBBI, Emily Schwing reports.
As part of the Magnuson-Stevens Reauthorization Act, Congress requested an examination of the availability of scientists trained to conduct high-quality research regarding fish stocks in the United States. Steve Morosky is the chief science advisor for NOAA's National Marine Fishery Service.
They asked for this report to understand if, in fact, there were bottlenecks in the production of fishery science information that was important for managing fisheries.
And the report did indeed find bottlenecks.
The report indicates that we're only producing about half of the graduates we actually need in order to sustain this occupation. And it looks like the educational institutions of the United States are behind the supply curve, as it were, for fishery stock assessments.
According to the report, only about 160 fishery stock assessment scientists will have graduated from U.S. institutions in the next decade. But there's a demand for anywhere between 180 and 340 marine scientists nationally in the next 10 years. The report examines the demand for marine scientists at NOAA and elsewhere, including regional fisheries commissions, state agencies, and other organizations. Jim Berkson is a professor at Virginia Tech. He's also a fishery scientist with NOAA. He says there are a number of reasons for the shortage of scientists.
Number one, there's an insufficient number of faculty in the discipline, and that means there are not enough courses being offered and not enough supervision and research opportunities available to graduate students. Secondly, there's an insufficient number of graduate students in the discipline, and that's primarily because funding is limited, as are students interested in the field.
Berkson adds that early education also plays a role in the lack of marine scientists.
What we're seeing is a national trend, first of all, of decreasing quality of quantitative undergraduate education. This has been reported by the National Research Council, the National Science Foundation. It's a national trend that basically the students aren't getting as strong a math background.
In the report, there are 9 core courses that make up the curriculum recommended for universities. Many of those courses are already offered in Alaska, and Murawski says the University of Alaska Fairbanks is at the head of the pack when it comes to training NOAA's future marine scientists.
University of Alaska Fairbanks has a number of field operations. They have the campus down in Southeast Alaska, and they have a number of faculty, and they have what we would consider a critical mass. They teach a substantial portion of the core. There are many relationships that we've identified with UAF, and we get a lot of our graduate students, particularly in the region there, from that school, that series of schools.
Berkson adds that more funding to train students in marine scientists could become available.
Now, fortunately, the president's 2009 budget includes a request for an additional $1 million in graduate fellowships. So that will help with that one component, the graduate component.
That $1 million would be added to an already existing $200,000 that funds a cooperative fellowship between NOAA and the Sea Grant program. But Berkson says the problem won't be solved by only increasing funding.
We have to have the faculty in place to teach the classes and supervise the graduate students. That's not a trivial task. And then we have to have the undergraduates interested in going into graduate school to fill those places, because right now, if we did ramp up the fellowship program to that extent, we don't have enough students ready and interested to go in and fill those positions.
NOAA's Marine Fishery Service is the leading employer of stock assessment and fishery scientists, and according to the report, filling those positions will only become more difficult as older scientists begin to retire. In Homer, I'm Emily Schwing.
A large wind turbine has gone online in Delta Junction. The turbine is the first of several planned at a wind farm being developed by Fairbanks-based Alaska Environmental Power. Company managing partner Mike Kraft says the wind power generator is an updated version of units installed in Alaska villages in recent years.
It's a Northwind 100 kW turbine that was designed for Antarctica. And we have the first of the B models. There were five of the A models were installed in the rural communities in Alaska over the last couple of years through the Denali Commission and the Alaska Energy Authority. And we caught on to their product and contacted their company.
Kraft says technicians from Northwind Corporation are spending a week commissioning the new turbine, which feeds Golden Valley electric distribution lines. The multi-million dollar project has so far been privately financed by Kraft and two local investors. He says they have plans for similar wind farms in Healy and other sites he's not willing to disclose.
Basically the same thing as gold mining. You know, I go out there and run around and find properties that are available and find out, what kind of land use issues are going on in that area and what kind of wind regime is there and what kind of access and power lines. So there's a lot of research that goes into finding the right spot.
Kraft says the vision is to install dozens of even larger turbines in coming years, some with blade spans of more than 200 feet. He says the potential to tap state and federal renewable energy grants could drastically speed up the process. He says the ultimate goal is to prove the technology in Alaska and supply up to 20% of rail belt power.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the new AT&T, your world delivered.
And by the Alaska Engineering News Fund, whose contributors include Dowell Engineers, providing civil and transportation engineering, land surveying, and planning services on the web at dowell.com.
Last month, the Anchorage School District Administration predicted the deteriorating economy of Bush, Alaska would produce a migration of rural families to urban areas of the state, especially Anchorage. That prediction has proven more accurate than expected. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Anchorage School Superintendent Carol Como is not surprised at the appearance of students from the Bush. It's the numbers.
From looking at our increase, it looks like it's probably between 400 and 450 to this point, and people are still coming in, so it's much more than I thought it was going to be.
In its 2008-2009 budget, the district estimated student enrollment would be just under 48,000. According to the district tally taken last week, the total student enrollment was over 48,400. Doreen Brown, director of the Indian Education Program, told the district's public affairs department that approximately 500 new Native students have registered since August 26th. Brown said anecdotal reports from teachers say the bulk are from rural Alaska. The extra numbers do mean more money for the Anchorage School District in the form of per-student funding support from the state. But Como worries about the impact on rural communities and schools.
I just really am very concerned. I think the state's in a real crisis right now. And yes, they're moving into Anchorage, and that's benefiting us as far as getting more students. But it's a very sad commentary on the situation for all these families.
There's also the challenge of helping some of the students adjust to their new surroundings. The district will be hiring more staff. Some will fall under the Indian Education Program and will include aides who help Alaska Native students make the transition to city schools. Como also says for families fleeing the economic conditions of rural Alaska, the schools could be their first contact for assistance here in Anchorage.
The Child in Transition program, you know, with a number of these families would qualify for extra support from them because if they're bunking, if you will, with relatives, they are technically considered homeless until they, you know, establish their own residency. And so that's another contact for some of these families to get some school supplies.
All the district schools are trying to help newly arrived rural students. But Como says the district needs to let parents of grade school children know they have an alternative to neighborhood schools. Namely, the Alaska Native Cultural Charter School.
I'm actually hoping a number of the elementary families will really look seriously at our Alaska Native Cultural Charter School, because I think with the way that that program is operating, it's a perfect transitional program for elementary students.
The kindergarten through sixth grade charter school began in August and has struggled to attract the needed 151 students. That's the number that makes the school eligible for over $1 million in state financial support. At 150 students or less, that support drops to about $600,000 for the school year. Facility and staff costs for the first year are budgeted at $1 million. The official student count takes place during October. As of this week, the Alaska Native School was tantalizingly close to the funding mark.
We are at 148 children, so we need three more kids.
Elizabeth Hancock is the administrative assistant at the new charter school. Hancock says they think they've found the solution to not only getting those three students, but perhaps a comfortable buffer of 20 to 30 more. Unlike other charter schools, the Native school will provide limited bus service. But as Hancock says, there's a deadline.
We need to have as many families who are interested in having their child picked up from an area school to call the school by Tuesday to let us know where they are so we can lay out the demographics and figure out the best route to get these kids here.
The school also has a free and reduced lunch program. The charter school has the same standards as any other district school, but emphasizes Alaska Native cultures and traditions with a hands-on, active inquiry teaching base. Students need not be Native to attend. This is Len Anderson.
A group of skateboarders made a difference at a meeting of the Petersburg City Council this month. The group objected to a proposed ordinance to expand the restrictions on the sport throughout town. In response to skater testimony, the council unanimously agreed to make some changes to the measure. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
Skateboards should not be singled out from using the street. What about when we play ball, both basketball and baseball, or ride bikes or rollerblade?
I believe there should be consequences for reckless acts. But I say this ordinance is not the solution.
And I personally don't skateboard, but I know a lot of people who do, and they're very safe about it, even in the streets. They avoid traffic, and I think it kind of singles them out from other sports and activities.
Those are just a few of the many skateboarders and skateboarding supporters who spoke at the council's public hearing. They were opposed to an ordinance that would expand the area where skateboarding is not allowed in town. Landscaper and longtime skateboarder Matt Garrett asked the council to send the measure back to the Public Safety Advisory Board so that, as he put it, the law can be written fairly and skateboarders did not feel so singled out.
By fairly, I mean that the law needs to apply to anyone who enjoys whizzing down a hill on wheels, whether that is on a bike, rollerblade, scooter, or whatever.
Garrett said education was the key, and he offered to help teach kids how to be safe while skating. The Public Safety Advisory Board developed the ordinance at the request of Mayor Al Dwyer, who had safety concerns after hearing from a member of the public who almost hit a skateboarder in her car.
And he came out from between a couple of cars or something. He was crouched down, so you didn't see him when she was backing up. And her heart stopped when she felt she could have hit him very easily. So she came to my house and asked me to bring this in front of the Public Safety Board.
Currently, skateboarding is only prohibited on the road and sidewalks of Main Street. The new measure would extend that ban to the sidewalks and side streets roughly a block beyond Main Street, but the part that generated the most concern among the public was a prohibition against skateboarding on the driven portion of any street in the city. Upon realizing this, Dwyer said even he objected to taking the ban that far, as did the rest of the counselors, like Bob Nilsson.
Skateboarding, I feel, is just the same as these kids do if a skateboard is known different than a bicycle. I've had a lot more close encounters with bicycles. So the way it reads now, I can't support this.
Ultimately, the council decided to make a significant amendment to the ordinance so that the rules for skateboarding on streets mirrored the rules for bicycling. It was clear to Mayor Al Dwyer that there would also be some value in making improvements to the town's small local skate park in the future.
It sounds to me like the city manager is going to have to put something in the budget next year to deal with this skate park. It sounds like it's a real good idea. It sounds like it's something that will be used, for sure. And make it as nice as Juno's. They have a beautiful one.
The council passed the amended ordinance in its second reading unanimously Monday. The council could make additional changes at the October 6th meeting when it will vote on the third and final reading of the measure. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Joe Vicnicki and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Wells Fargo, financial pioneers in Alaska nearly a century ago, bringing Alaskans to the next stage. WellsFargo.com, the next stage. And by
Grant Station, finding grants for nonprofit organizations, schools, and governmental agencies throughout the U.S. and Canada. Grant Station, fast track to funding. On the web at grantstation.com.
The Division of Elections reminds voters that Tuesday, November 4th, is Election Day. Polling places will be open from 7 a.m. until 8 p.m. To find your polling place, call 1-888-383-8683. If you need language or other assistance while voting, you may ask the election board or bring a person of your choice to assist you. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Division of Elections.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.